Okay, welcome to the next lecture in KDD. Most of you haven't been here on Friday, so I guess our entry into the OLAP chapter isn't known to everybody in here. I don't think you need that to understand what we are talking about today, but we have to do a short introduction for you to be at our point. Last week we talked about, we finished up the pre-processing chapter and we talked about OLAP in some detail. We stopped at this slide, which is basically the continuation of the different kinds of schemata we have within an OLAP database. An OLAP database is an online analytical processing database, which is tailored to analytical processing. So basically what we are doing in here. For a database like that, we often use a relational database. And this relational database basically has a core fact table and some dimensions based on that fact table. Basically, you have to think about that in a way that we have, if we have three dimensions, that we have a three-dimensional cube. With the three dimensions, let's use time. Let's use location. And let's use branch. Then we can select specific subcubes within that bigger cube by limiting specific rates within the time. For example, if we say we only want measurements out of 2023, then we can cut a slice out of that bigger cube. And within that bigger cube, we have little measurements which are the basic entries within that thing. Basically, a measurement within this specific star schema might be something like time, eight o'clock at the 1st of April, 23. Branch is X. Location is Erlangen. And then we have three measurements. One is units sold. Let's say 13. Dollar sold. $1,000, and of course, I just do not have any space for that, average sold as well. And we have multiple measurements that fall into that specific slice in here. And what we can do within our data warehouse is to calculate an average for that specific slice. So everything that is within that specific slice can be, for example, averaged, or in general, processed with an aggregation function. So an aggregate function. Average is just one aggregation function we can talk about. We can have something like min, we can have something like max, we can have something like count. Those are all aggregation functions. And for all little data entries within a specific slice, or if we specify more than one one dimension, if we specify two dimensions, for example, we limit the branch as well, then we end up not with a slice, but with a smaller dice if we also limit the branch. Of course, I should try it like that. And we can do the same thing, limiting the data points and aggregating the specific facts or measurements in all data points within that cube or that slice. Within OLAP, we have two possible ways to create that within, well, not two possible, but two main ways to create that within a relational database schema. One is, of course, what I've already said. We have a central fact table, and for every dimension, we have one specific table. And we just link those tables via foreign key to our fact table. So we do not really have these specific things within the same table, but we have foreign keys to those dimensions within that fact table. And our way to do that is to create a snowflake schema, where we do not have one table for each dimension, but one table for each granularity. In that case, or in that slide, we do not have one table per granularity, but one table for some granularity steps. In the literature, you would name that something in between a star schema and a snowflake schema, but most agree that anything where not only one table exists per dimension is more of a snowflake schema than of a star schema. And we have somehow mixed form of both schemas, not mixed form, can be done with both a snowflake schema and a star schema, where we have multiple fact tables linking to the same dimensions, because you might reuse a dimension time. The dimension time isn't different for any of us. You can have the dimension time, the same dimension time for any shop, but you can have the dimension time also for a university, for example. The dimension time works always, and we can reuse that if we want. That's a fact constellation. The important part, and that's a new part, where we didn't talk about on Friday, and so if you rewatch the video of Friday, you will see that, is the concept hierarchy. Because I already mentioned within the Snowflake schema that we have a specific table per granularity. But what's a granularity within this OLAP data schema? Basically, and I'm again in the wrong dimension, we have a concept hierarchy. Within a location hierarchy, it might be that we have the region first, so Europe, North America. Below that, in a finer granularity, we have the countries. So for example, for Europe, we might be in Germany, we might be in Spain. But we are at the same time also in Europe, of course, if you're in Germany. At the lower level, we have city, Frankfurt. And we might have different offices within the same city. That's a concept hierarchy. We have a lowest granularity. In this case, it might be the office. And all tuples that are part of LChen, in this case, are, of course, also part of Vancouver, are of course also part of Canada, are of course also part of North America. So we can limit our data cube not only within a specific time, but we can limit it on specific granularity levels. For example, we can limit everything that's happened within 2023, but we can also say we only want things that happened within January of 2023, which is a much smaller slice or dice of original data. Which is useful because sometimes you want to process a lot of data per year. Sometimes you want a smaller subset of the data from a specific month. And basically, that's the big difference between the star schema and the Snowflake schema, that within the star schema, we have one table containing all granularity levels, and therefore we have a lot of redundancy. Because if we, and I will just use day, month, year in this case, if we have day, month, and year, then we have the 1st of January in the year 2000. We have the 2nd of January. We have the 3rd of January 2000. And therefore, we have a lot of redundancy because the year is within the table 365 times. The same year is written down 365 times. A Snowflake schema would have one table for day with a foreign key to the month. So this, and then we have the table for month, which is itself has a foreign key to year, and so on. And therefore, we only need the entry, 2000, of course, for this month, one time in a table. So it saves a lot of space, but requires a lot of linking if we use the Snowflake schema. However, in the star schema, we have a lot of redundancy, and therefore have a bit better performance because we do not have to rejoin the tables. Within the data cube measures, I already talked about the facts. So, for example, unit sold, dollar sold. Can someone turn his or her vibration off? Because that's pretty annoying. These facts, or is that some builders maybe? Okay, maybe, I don't know. These facts can be of different kinds. So unit sold, dollar sold. We might have things that are distributive, where we can apply aggregation functions like count, sum, min, max, without any problem. But we can have also things that are work better with algebraic functions like average, min number, and standard deviation. Or maybe we should first discuss that, the aggregation type, to be easier, to have an easier explanation for the thing before. Basically, we have three kinds of measurements. We have flow, stock, and value per unit. A flow is a value that can be aggregated as desired, because it's a specific measurement that is happening at a time. For example, if we sell units, and we sell units in a second data point, so we sell units at 8 p.m. in the 1st of January 2000, and then we sell 12 units at the at 9 p.m. at 9 a.m. At the 1st of January 2024. Then we can sum that up without a problem. But what's happening if we have, and I will just use time as a timestamp, if we have stock at time one, we have a stock of 200 items. At time two, we have a stock of 150 items. Who knows whether these 150 items are part of that stock or not? Because we might just have sold 50 items between those two timestamps, but we might also have sold 100 items and rebought 50 of them. We can't tell. So stock is not aggregatable in any way, in a specific way, in a desired way, maybe. Because flow, so unit sold, that's flow. Stock isn't aggregatable in that dimension. However, you can do things like average. An average works for that. If you say average, we know that we have an average stock of 175 items. So we can use specific aggregate functions for that as well. And then there are things like tags or a unit price that isn't aggregatable in a summation way. So we can sum that up. Again, let's use two timestamps, and we have value per unit. So let's go with item price. And the item costs €1 at time one and €1.10 at time two. When we can't just sum that up, because the item never costed €2.10. That's not possible to do. And these different kinds of measurements or facts, of course, play into our different categories of aggregation functions. Account, sum, min, max, the sum doesn't make sense, for example, with a value per unit price. However, the average and the standard deviation do make sense for something like that. Because we might want to know how much variance is within our price. If we have the oil price, for example, that's a very specific measurement we want to know about the oil price. How much variance is within the price? And these categories of aggregations play, of course, into our aggregation type. Some things that are always applicable, of course, are min, max, and average, because these things work with value per unit, the stock, and the flow. But you have to know which value you have, which kind of value you have, to be able to select the correct aggregation functions. If you do not know that about a fact, you can't use it. We already talked about the dimensions. There, something I didn't mention yet might happen. We might have a split hierarchy. Because if we take a look at the calendar week, this calendar week might span multiple weeks. Not weeks, but multiple months. We might, or we have a good example in this week. This calendar week is starting in April, in May, and is ending in June. Or am I wrong? Yeah, I do think so. So we might have hierarchies where we have to select which path we want to use to select our subvalues. However, that's not a problem for any value. We just have to select the correct path. I've already drawn a data cube, not that pretty, but I've only explained that, so I will skip that. In that specific data cube we have here, we have three dimensions: product, date, and country. And we can create different cuboids, so different subsets of that big cube, where we either select anything, so every dimension, and we end up with the original cube. Or we can only select product, a specific date, a specific country. Or we can select a combination of product date, product country, date country. Or we can select a specific product, specific date in a specific country. Those are all options. That's all we can talk about today in here. We can also talk about some specific OLAP operations we have. On one side, we have the roll-up, which is summarization of data. For example, if we are currently taking a look at our cube at the level of months, we take a look at every month, then we can roll up that view on the data by not taking a look at the months anymore, but taking a look at the cube per year. That would be a roll up, because we go from the lower granularity to the higher granularity. Roll up. The reverse of roll up is drill down, so we have taken a look at a yearly overview of the data and go to a monthly overview of the data, or a daily overview of the data, which is pretty simple to understand if you know that concept of the dimension hierarchy. Something I already mentioned while explaining the cube is that we have two different operations. If we only limit one dimension, we slice the cube, because we cut out a slice of a cube. If we limit more than one dimension, we not anymore talk about a slice, but we talk about a dice. That's also true if we not limit exactly three dimensions, but if we limit any more than one dimension. So one dimension limit is a slice, more than one dimension is always a dice operation. Then something you might know from Excel or something like that is a pivot, where we just take a look at the cube from another direction. So we rotate the cube, basically. That's especially helpful if we have a two-dimensional table, which contains more than two dimensions. Then we can take a pivot and take a look at another dimension. We might do that in the exercise. I don't think it's that important for us, so let's go through that. And some other operations are drill across, where we take a look at more than one fact table. So these little dots are fact tables, basically. And we might have a fact constellation. So this one. And if we take a look at multiple of them at the same time, then we have drill across. And a drill through is the case where we take a look at the little dots. Because in most cases in OLAP, we are not interested in the single entries within our database. We are more interested in aggregations of values, summarizations of values. But sometimes we might want to take a look at the single data entries within that data cube. And that's a drill through. And I'm now thinking, yeah, okay, that's fine. Okay, those are the basics of OLAP together with the recording of last week's, of Friday's lecture, which was released on the weekend. I don't think everybody has seen that yet. It should be enough to understand data warehouses in general. Now we can also talk about different views on a data warehouse. Because we might want to discuss the stakeholders of a data warehouse. Let's start maybe with the simplest view. We have a business query view, where a business person just want to know how many units are sold in 2023. He or she isn't interested in how the data warehouse is constructed. Why should he or she worry about that? While a data engineer is, of course, more interested in the data warehouse view, because he or she wants to know which dimensions are there, which fact tables are there, what can I do with that? Then there's a data source view, where, and that's something I didn't mention today, that's part of the last week's lecture, where we, a data warehouse always consists out of data from original data sources. So we might have Excel sheets behind that, we might have other operational relational databases behind that, that together with an extract transform load process create our data warehouse. And sometimes I want to know where is my data from, because that might give something away. And we might have a top-down view, which is basically all relevant information. As a data scientist, and I will just assume that most of you are data scientists in here, you might be interested in all of these views, because you might have to combine multiple data sources into a data warehouse for your job to work. That might be your job, to combine multiple data sources into a specific data warehouse. You might also just be interested in the data warehouse view because you have to maintain a data warehouse for your job. But also, if you are more about the performance of data science projects, so performing, for example, a frequent pattern analysis, then you are more about the business query view. But basically, it can go in any direction for all of you. Within these different views, we, of course, have different kinds of creating a data warehouse. With a top-down process, we start with overall design of a data warehouse and planning. While in the bottom-up, we start with the lowest level, so we start with what we want to have, do experiments and prototypes, and go up to the design of a data warehouse. So we start either with experiments and build on that to create the structure, which is bottom up, or we go the other way around. From a software engineering point, we can talk about things like waterfall model, spiral model, agile model, most of things that we can always discuss about that. I will skip that because I don't think it's that common to have something like that applied to the creation of a data warehouse. Sometimes you have, especially with bigger data warehouses, but with smaller data warehouses, it's often not necessary to go through a whole design process for that. And of course, within the data warehouse design process, you of course always have to know which things are important for your business users. So what things should be saved and analyzed? Because if you do not know that you want to analyze business data like orders or invoices or things like that, then you can do that. You have to choose a granularity for the atomic level of data. Because you might say, I just want to save monthly data, because that saves storage space. Then the little dots are already summarized to a monthly level. A monthly level is, of course, very, very high for an entry point, because you can't get lower than that if you choose to do that. You have to choose the dimensions, and of course, you have to choose the measurements of effects for your database. I guess that's easy to understand. However, the data warehouse construction process is, especially with bigger data warehouses, not an easy feat. You might remember Mel, Mrs. Siegel from Prodato. She mainly does that within. She talks to other companies and gives them recommendations how to do that. And since they pay someone to come and explain that to them, it doesn't seem to be an easy feat to do. We will skip the data warehouse recommended approach. It will not be part of the exam then, if skip that, so we can save some time in here. Of course, you can ask me something about that, but it's not part of the exam. Now, the last thing we want to talk about is we are basically in OLAP, in the online analytical processing world, and we want to get to online analytical mining. What is that? Or why do we want that? We know, and that's something I talked about on Friday, that a data warehouse contains consistent and cleaned data, so already pre-processed data. Within that database, that OLAP database, we can begin with some basic operations, like drilling, dicing, pivoting, so selecting subsets. And of course, that's already a kind of analysis we do. And by implementing algorithms directly within that scope, we can select a specific data mining function directly in the database and save time. This is the general data mining process, data warehouse process, which we already discussed last time, where we have some data sources, do the extract, transform, load process, get to the data warehouse, and have data marts. We can also apply some basic data measurements functions directly here to get to online analytical mining. However, I want to end that in here at this point with just a little summary. where, yeah, we talked about data warehousing in that chapter, specifically online analytical processing and the combined data warehouses with that. We talked about how a data warehouse is created using a star schema and a snowflake schema, or maybe even a fact constellation. And we talked about some very specific things like a multi-tiered architecture, like the business analysis design framework, and things like that. Are there any questions regarding data warehouses or OLAP in general? I don't think so. Again, you can always ask in a forum, because I, again, do not think that everybody is able to ask questions about all the slides, so feel free to come up with questions later. And we go to the next big chapter, which is back to data mining. Now we are not at the basis saving data, so we are now at using the data. Frequent pattern analysis. And I have to add that that's the first chapter we will have an implementation task to in the submissions. The submission task starts at 10th of June, I think. Look that up in the Sturon forum. And we will probably get to the first function or first method you have to implement today. So maybe try to understand the concepts. We will talk about, within the frequent pattern analysis chapter, we will talk about some basic concepts. What are frequent patterns? We will talk about some methods. These methods have to be implemented a priori and FP growth, to be specific. We are talking about how to use association rules, whatever that is, from frequent item sets, whatever that is. We will talk about that later. We will talk about which patterns are interesting with pattern evaluation methods. I hope we get to the mid of a second part today. That would be a good rate to get to. So let's start with basic concepts. First, what is a frequent pattern analysis, or what is a frequent pattern? A frequent pattern is basically a pattern, so a set of items, subsequences, substructures that occurs frequently within a specific data set. Let's do it more general. Within an online shop, for example, you might have a frequent pattern of customers often buying shoes and shoelaces together. That's a frequent pattern, because two items are bought together very often. You often see something that is based on frequent patterns within online shops. That's from Amazon. They do that using frequent patterns, because they analyze things that orders that customers purchased and try to analyze or try to give you recommendations based on that frequent pattern. It's of course part of many shops. I think I've screenshotted Amazon, Best Buy, I guess, and Mindfactory in this case. Just to give you some examples, there are a lot more in the web. So the motivation of the frequent pattern analysis is that we want to find inherent regularities within the data. So, for example, what products are often bought together? That's basically the example I've shown you. What is often bought after buying item X? For example, if I buy a PC, will I also buy a keyboard? That's pretty useful to know for the shop owner. But of course, It might also be useful in other use cases when an online shop, for example, if we do a drug study, a study on a drug, on a new drug, it might be useful for us to know which problems, if problems occur, how often do they occur with specific DNA sequences. That might be helpful to not use that drug with a specific DNA sequence. Or it can be useful to, for example, to analysis of your web page where clicks are often occurring together. So maybe I click on buy and I click on menu item X very often within the same session. Then it might be useful to put both buttons together, close together, to have a better human customer, human and computer interaction. Why is that important, that frequent pattern mining important? A frequent pattern is something that is already within the dataset. It's always present within the dataset. We can't create that frequent pattern. However, we need that to find that frequent pattern, which is already here, to do very useful things. For example, we can also get correlation, because if I buy a product together, it's of course some kind of correlation. We can get through the correlation to a causality analysis. Again, correlation doesn't imply causality, very important, but it can be something pointing to causality. We can do things like classification later on. We can do a cluster analysis. So which products are bought together might build a cluster, or products that are bought together might build a cluster. There are a lot of applications for frequent pattern mining, and some are already doing frequent pattern mining by itself. I already have shown you with real-world examples. Now we have to talk about specific things within our frequent pattern mine analysis, names within that. Let's think about a small example. That's a transactional data set. We have a transaction which has a transaction ID, the TID, so transaction ID. And each transaction contains some items that are bought. So within transaction 10, we have beer, nuts, and diapers being bought. And we now want to use that transactional database to come up with a frequently bought together column within our database, maybe. Not database, our website. Then we have to first talk about what this transaction contains. So the combination of beer, nuts, and diapers is called an item set, a set of items. It can be also one item set, but most times it will be more item sets. A K item set is an item set containing K items. So beer, nuts, diapers would be a free item set. Free not as in no cost, but in the number free, of course. With an item set, we can determine how often this item set is occurring within the database. And frequent pattern mining basically says if a certain threshold is surpassed, then an item set is frequent. For example, if we say if beer is within our transactional database for more than three times, in more than three different transactions, then it's frequent. Let's count it, 1, 2, 3. So it would be frequent. This threshold would be called support. We can have two different kinds of support. We can either have an absolute support, so we say a specific number that has to be surpassed to become frequent. For example, 3 times. That's an absolute support. Or we can have a relative support where we say at least 50% of transactions, the item must be contained, or the item set must be contained. And we define that if that support threshold, be it relative or be it absolute, is surpassed, then the item set is called frequent. And we get a frequent item set. We can have frequent 1 item sets, we can have frequent 2 item sets, we can have frequent 3 item sets. These item sets, especially item sets with count higher or equal 2, can be used then to create an association rule, which is something I already mentioned before, where we say, if I buy an item set X, I probably also buy an item set Y. That's an association rule. If I buy X, I probably also buy Y. This can be done by taking a look at all frequent K bigger than 2 or bigger equal 2 item sets, splitting up into an X and a Y part, and then looking for confidence. How confident are we that X also contains Y? Let's do that on our example. If we determine that our support is relative and we want 50% of transactions containing an item set for it to become frequent, then we can take a look at our transactional database, and we see that since beer, nuts, diapers, and eggs have an occurrence count of higher than 2.5, to be specific, we have 3, 3, 4, 3 for item counts, those item sets are frequent. But also we have a 2-item set, combination of beer and diapers, being frequent because it also occurs 3 times. It occurs up here in transaction 10, it occurs in transaction 20, it occurs in transaction 30. So it occurs 3 times, satisfies our threshold, our min support, and therefore it's also a frequent item set. So we have 5 frequent item sets in our database. Now we can check the 2-item set, because 1-item sets can become association rules, for being an association rule. If we take a look at the combination beer, if we buy beer, we also buy diapers, we can just take a look at every transaction containing beer, 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 and just count how often that beer leads to also diapers. So beer also leads to diapers. Check. Right now we are at 100%. Beer also leads to diapers. We are still at 100%. And beer leads to diapers, so we are at 100% confidence. 100% of times, if you buy beer, we also buy diapers. The same can also be done the other way around, where of course in the first 3 transactions, yeah, we are fine. But diapers is also part of the transaction 50, and this time it doesn't lead to beer. Therefore, we have only a confidence of 75%. But since we set our threshold for the confidence at 50%, both association rules are still considered valid association rules. Well, not only valid association rules, but so-called strong association rules, because it satisfies minimum support and minimum confidence. The confidence of a rule, of course, can easily be determined, which I have basically done within my example in here, by just counting how often both items occur together, so both sides, both item sets occur together, divided through the count of the left item set, so item set A, which is basically what I've done with diapers and diapers and beer, because I have 3 diapers and beer and 4 diapers occurrences, which is basically 75%. An association rule mining algorithm would first find all frequent item sets and then use every frequent item set longer than 2 item sets, or longer equal 2, to generate association rules. So to do association rule mining, which is part of frequent pattern mining, we first need to determine frequent item sets. Basically, there are some special item sets. We have closed item sets and max item sets. Basically, the concept is that a long item set, an item set, let's say, of 100 items, contains a lot of subsets. Because, for example, if I have the item set A, B, C, and that's not really wrong, of course, but let's go with that for an easy explanation. We have the subsets A, B, B, C, and A, C. And of course, also A, B, C contained within that bigger item set. And the bigger the original item set, the more sub-item sets we have, of course. To be specific, with an item set length of 100, we would have 1.72 times 10 to the power of 30 sub-item sets. So very, very many item sets. And to check all these items for being frequent, we can also mine, we can also mine specific item sets. Because if we take a look at the so-called closed item sets, which are item sets that are frequent for themselves and do not have any super item set with the same support as X, we know that if that specific item set X is frequent, all subsets of that item set are also frequent. And we therefore do not, so if we know that this specific item set is frequent or has a support satisfying the threshold, we know that this item set is, all subsets also have to be frequent, and we do not have to take a look at them. So if we mine frequent closed item sets, we can easily check whether an item set and all sub-item sets are also frequent. But we also have max item sets, which are even better, because in this case, we do not only check that there's no super item set with the same item set count, But we also check that there is no frequent super item set. The difference between both of them is that with the closed item sets, we might have something like A, B, C, with an item set count of 4. And we have an item set A, B, C, and D, with an item set count of 3. This would still be a closed item set if there are no other super item sets with the same support or occurrence count. Because it does have, the super item set does have an other item set count. If we have now min sub of 3, then of course this wouldn't be a max item set. I see some confused faces. what is the problem right now? General. Is the problem item sets? Hopefully not. And this is just an example. It's an example not linked to anything I've written down before. It's just an example to explain why it can be that something is a closed item set but isn't a max item set. In this specific example, we would be, because we have an other count than this, in here, it would be a closed item set because there is supposedly no super item set with the same count. This would be a closed item set. However, it wouldn't be a max item set because there is a super item set that is still frequent. I still see some confused things. Can you tell me what your problems where you didn't understand what I'm telling you anymore? Because there has to be some point where you skipped my explanation. Okay, doesn't want to say anything. Yeah?
What is a super item set?
Okay, super item set is basically an item set containing, so we have the item set X, and a super item set of item set X would be any item set that contains all items of the item set plus any amount of other item sets. Items, not item sets. So since we have items A, B, C within that item set, any item set with an extra, minimum one extra item would be a super item set. As we have D extra to A, B, C in this case, it's a super item set of X. But it can also be, so if we add an E, it would also be a super item set. Because it contains the original items plus any amount of other items. This wouldn't be a super item set because it doesn't contain all items of the original item set. It would be just another item set. No super item set. There's no specific name to that. It's just not a super item set. This problem solved? Yeah?
Which one would be closed and which one would be the max item set in this case, if it was A, B, C, and E?
Okay. First thing, we have to assume that there are no other super item sets, of course. If there are any other super item sets, we can't do that. But let's say we just have the items A, B, C, and D in the original transactional database, so there are no more items we can have to generate a super item set, okay? Then in this case, A, B, C would have a support count of 4, and A, B, C, D, which is super item set of A, B, C, and we say whether it's the only super item set, because we just do that for our example, has an count of 3. Then let's first check whether X is a closed item set. Okay, let's look at that. ABC has a count of 4, and the only super item set has a count of 3. If we take a look at the definition of closed item sets, we say that if the item set is frequent, yeah, it does satisfy our threshold, and there exists no super item set with the same support as X, it's closed. There is a super item set, and this is frequent. However, they do not have the same support count. Therefore, X is frequent. Is closed, sorry, not frequent. The same is also true for Y, because A, B, C, D does satisfy the min threshold to become frequent. It satisfies 3. And there is no super item set of this item set that has the same support count, because there is no other super item set. So there can't be any with the same support count. Therefore, both of them are closed in this example. However, if we now go to max item sets, we have to check something other. We have to take a look at X again. It's frequent, yeah. And Y is also frequent. So X has a superset which is frequent. And therefore, X is not a max item set, because there's a frequent superset, super item set. While with Y, we do not have any super item sets, and Y is frequent, therefore Y is a max item set. Is that explanation helping? Okay. We will do something like that within, I hope I have that within the exercises. If not, I will add it into the exercises, because tasks like that have sometimes been part of the exam. So we might want to do a specific task for that in the exercise. If it's not part of the exercise, I will add it. Any questions right here? Any questions you can explain what you want to know about that? If not, we can talk about that later on. I've already done an example. I don't think these examples would help anymore, because it's basically the same thing I've done here. And we have to go to frequent item set mining methods. Because, of course, in a small data set like that, we can do that by just taking a look at it, and we should be able to find all frequent item sets, I guess, if you understood the item sets and the naming. However, an algorithm can't just take a look at something and say, yeah, works. We have to find a good way to do things. And most of these methods are based on a certain property of frequent item sets, a property that I already mentioned. I just didn't name it that way. We have the so-called downward closure property of frequent item sets, or frequent patterns. And that's basically any subset of a frequent item set must also be frequent. Subset, as you didn't know super item set, subset is just the other way around. So a subset of an item set, X in this case, is a subset of Y. Because in X, only items are contained that are also in Y, but there's one, at least one less item within the item set. So it's a subset. And if we know that any item set is frequent, we already also know that any subset is frequent. We can think about that the other way around. If we already know that an item set is infrequent, so it doesn't satisfy the threshold, then the supersets can be frequent as well. So if we have min support 5 in this case, we know that ABC is not frequent in this case anymore, because the threshold isn't satisfied. Right? And therefore, we do not even have to check ABCD, because the count of ABCD can be higher than the count of ABC. Therefore, ABCD can be frequent. I hope that's logical to most of you. Any questions about that? Because I again see some confused persons in here. Maybe I should go back to this example. If I count beer and I get to the count of 3, there's no possibility that any item combined with beer is occurring more often than beer. Because how should I have more customers or more transactions containing beer and diapers than transactions only containing beer? That's not possible. So if I counted that beer only occurs 3 times, and I need, in this example, not that example I've printed in here, so, but a fictitious example, if I have a min support of 4, and I already know beer isn't satisfying this threshold, then I also know that beer and diapers can't satisfy that threshold. I hope that's helping. I'm not sure about that today. If you have questions, you can always come and ask. And this idea that if an item set is frequent, I do not have to check or generate the supersets, is a base principle of an algorithm called a priori, which is arguably the most used frequent pattern mining algorithm today. And one of the methods you have to implement later, again. Basically, a priori is working by a very simple concept. We start by scanning our database once for all frequent one item sets. So we go through our database and just go through each transaction. Let's start with transaction 10. We write down beer 1. Then we get to nuts. New item set, 1 item set, 1. Then we get to diapers, 1. When we get into the next transaction, all beer is already in our list, let's count to 2. And so on, until we get through every transaction and have a count for every item set. Then we generate combinations of length k plus 1, since we was have been by one item sets, we now generate two item sets possible from the length k frequent item sets. Then we go through the list of item sets again, count how often our candidate item sets occur within the database. And we go so long we find candidate item sets. Once we do not find any candidate item sets anymore, we terminate. No worries, I have an example for that. Let's go with a simpler database. So our database is containing 4 transactions in this case and 5 possible letters. The first thing would be to scan for the occurrence counts of frequent of one item sets. So A, B, C, D, E. In this case, we would count, A is occurring 2 times, B is occurring 3 times, C is occurring 3 times, D is occurring 1 time, E is occurring 3 times. If we define min support as 2, then we would know that D is not part of the frequent item sets, and we therefore would would prune it and would end up with 4 one item sets being frequent, because they satisfy that min support. The next thing is this combine step. In that stage, it's pretty simple. We just combine every of these frequent item sets. Please note, D is not part of the frequent item sets and therefore doesn't become part of the combinations due to the a priori pruning principle. Doing combinations should be pretty simple to understand, I guess. Then we would go through the whole database again and just count how often these item sets occur. The combination of A and B only occurs once. A and C occurs twice, A and E occurs once, and so on. Just counting. Again, we have to prune everything that isn't frequent to get to our frequent 2 item sets. And now we get to a very important step of a combination that is often not performed well if I ask for a priori in the exam. Therefore, I emphasize that a lot. Once we are at the 2 item sets and combine that into possible candidates, we just get one example. Why is that? Because if we take a look at the items contained with our frequent two item sets, we have 4 items contained within that case. We have A, we have B, C, and E. All these items are, of course, contained within the frequent 2 item sets. So someone might say, hey, why don't I have A, B, C as a combination? B, C, E as a combination, A, C, E as a combination, is there any other combination of these 4 items? C, E, D, I don't think so. But why do I not end up with these 3 combinations? Why do I just end up with BCE? Any ideas? Why do I just end up with BCE as a combination? Sorry?
The high support value.
I do not know the high support value in the 2 item sets. This one? That doesn't have anything to do with that.
Because AB and AE are not part of L2.
AE. Correct. We have, within that pre-item set, we have a sub-item set, AE. And we already know that that sub-item set is not frequent. Therefore, it can be a possible frequent free-item set. Because we know that if the sub-item set is infrequent, there's no super-item set that gets frequent. Ah. In this case, of course, not AB, AE, but AB. And the same thing is true for AE in this case. We know that it's not frequent, and we can therefore skip that item set. While within BCE, we know that BC is frequent. We know that CE is frequent. We know that BE is frequent. So all contained sub-item sets are frequent, and only due to that, this becomes a candidate. Again, that's something I frequently ask in the exams. So, are there any questions regarding that? Yeah?
Another question, but there's also, just for completeness sake, there's also another one, another combination, A, B, and E, but it also doesn't check out.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I might missed A, B, and E. Yeah, of course, you're right. Yeah. But the same thing as with that, we have the problem that AB is not frequent. Yeah, you're correct. Thanks. Yeah.
So we will take all the subsets of the superset?
Yeah.
Just one is sufficient.
All sub item sets have to be frequent for that to become a candidate. It's still not a frequent item set by just being a candidate. We still have to count how often it occurs. In this case, it occurs often enough to be frequent. However, it might also happen that a candidate doesn't become frequent. But we wouldn't even generate it as a candidate if one or more subsets are infrequent. All of them have to be frequent. Okay? Pretty important part of that. My algorithm would work without that, however, it wouldn't be nearly as efficient as it is. And efficiency is something very important for algorithms. Yeah. We have some pseudocode for that, which is basically what I've said before on that slide, so I skip it. But this pseudocode can help you implement a priori in the submissions. So this is part of the slides. Basically, again, the reminder of a candidate generation, all subsets have to be part of the item set, otherwise we can't generate it, which is basically what this slide again says in some other words for you to read it up. Now we have to get to a problem with a priori, because in a small example like this, we only have 3 examples. But if you only take a look at this table leading up to these amount of candidates, if it wouldn't have just 4 frequent one-item sets, but we would have 300 frequent one-item sets, which is very small in real-world measurements, then we would have exponentially higher amount of candidates, because all have to be combined with all. So basically, we have 4 exclamation mark in math terms in this case, but 300 exclamation mark in another case. And we have a lot of combinations to count. This can again become inefficient because we have a huge amount of candidates we have to count, and for every candidate we have to go through that our database. Of course, we have to have two for loops. We have first to go through every transaction, and within each transaction we have to go through every candidate and check whether it's contained. Which is a problem. It can be solved by using a hash tree to be more efficient, to just take a look at certain candidates in a specific transaction. It can also be done with a subset function where we just take a look at candidates contained in a transaction. Those are pretty implementation-heavy techniques to solve that, or to ease that pressure on the candidates. We don't expect you to use any of them in the implementation of your implementation of a priori. In this case, you can do the simplest approach. But nevertheless, we want to talk about that. Let's say we have 15 candidate item sets, just a list of them. If we have a transaction 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, then we can split up our thing we have to look for with a subset function. In this case, this is a subset function. And if we, for example, take a look at 1, 4, 5, we would end up in the left branch of that thing. And we can just iterate through the whole tree to only count transactions really candidates all already contained within our transaction. We can also implement a priori in SQL directly, because near data processing is always more efficient. However, I wouldn't recommend to implement a priori within SQL if you are not an experienced SQL user. This is just for completeness. I will not ask for that statement in the exam or something like that. You will not be expected to write a priori with SQL in the exam, but it's fun to know that it's possible. But since SQL is Turing complete since some years, of course it can be done. We have some challenges with a priori. Again, we have that high count of candidates, which can be eased with hash maps, but not solved. And we also have to take a look at the database k times if the highest frequent item set is of length k, or even k plus 1 times if the highest item set is k. Because we have to always count the candidates, and and if you have a frequent 100 item set, we have to go through all of our database 100 times. A database is very, very performant. However, if you have a production database, for example, and iterate through that database 100 times for each frequent pattern analysis you do, the database doesn't like that. So it's not that good as well. To improve a priori, and even though I would say a priori is still the most used method, there are improvements to a priori. We can either reduce the passes of transaction database scans, or and shrink the number of candidates, or and implement something supporting us counting candidates. We already talked about hashing, or in this case, hash maps. Now we can do it with a hash table. If we put a K item set within the corresponding hashing bucket, and the total, and then just count the how often any of that item sets is occurring within the database for once, we know that if the total bucket count is below our threshold, then any item set within the hash table can be frequent as well. Easy example, maybe in this case. Let's say we have a database with possible items A, B, and D. A, B, and D. And we are at the step of two item sets. And we just have A, B, C being frequent. Or let's go with that, and every one item set is frequent. Then we might have to check for combination AB, combination AC, and combination BC. These are the candidates to check. Of course, small example, wouldn't make any sense to do that. This was such a small example in the real world, but easier to understand. And now we just split it up via a hashing function. Let's say our hashing function is the first item within that item set. So the first hash bucket would contain AB and AC. And of course, the second would contain just BC. Then we just go through our database and not look for single item sets, but as soon as one of these contained item sets is within the database, we just count up once. Example, let's say we end up with four for both, okay? And our min support is defined as five. Since we have counted four times here and four times here, we know that BC can't be frequent because we just counted how often it occurs. But we also know that neither AB nor AC can be frequent as well, because if we count up once, if at least one is contained in the transaction, then we can say that it's below min support for both. That enables us to decrease the things we have to check for. And of course, once the min support is fulfilled, we have to go through them again. Oh, time's up. Yeah. Let's stop here, and we will take a look at partitioning next week on Monday. Yeah, let's do that. Please remember me. Have a nice week. Until next time.